Our reading today is called My Life as a Protest by Thomas Merton. Quote, "It is my intention to make my entire life a rejection of, a protest against the crimes and injustices of war and political tyranny which threaten to destroy the whole human race and the world. By my life and vows, I am saying no to all the concentration camps, the aerial bombardments, the staged political trials, the judicial murders, the racial injustices, the economic tyrannies, and the whole social economic apparatus which seems geared for nothing but global destruction in spite of all its fair words in favor of peace. I make silence a protest against the lies of politicians, propagandists, and agitators. When I speak, it is to deny that my faith and my church can ever seriously be aligned with these forces of injustice and destruction. My life, then, must be a protest against those who invoke their faith in support of war, racial injustice, and tyranny. If I say no to all these secular forces, I also say yes to all that is good in the world and in humanity. I say yes to all that is beautiful in nature. I say yes to all the men and women who are my brothers and sisters in the world." Unquote. Today I'm reading a sermon fashioned by the Reverend Gretchen Haley, currently the senior minister at Foothills Unitarian in Fort Collins, Colorado. She wrote this sermon as an address to her congregation, and she has given me permission to modify her sermon to address our congregation. So I'm going to ask that you imagine that I am Reverend Gretchen Haley as I speak on the topic of beloved community of resistance. I was headed to a Jesuit monastery, which is not the same sort as where Thomas Merton lived, he whose words we heard in our reading today. He spent nearly 30 years of his life as a Trappist monk. Jesuits value some meaningfully different practices than those Trappists. For example, silence. The Ignatius House in Atlanta, Georgia, where I was headed, it turns out, has a regular practice of total mandatory silence. Not only would I not have my phone or my television or my streaming Netflix, but I would not have any other voices at all. I would instead only have my own voice in my own head, my own thoughts, my own self. Basically, going here was a requirement of the generous fellowship I had recently received, so I packed and headed off to what the prophet Elijah and Paul Simon called the Sounds of Silence, which in my experience is ironically quite loud. Now, the practice is not a 24-hour affair, but in review of the schedule, there it is, 7 p.m. silence until 9 the next morning. Well, 7 o'clock came. I took a walk around the campus. I sat on a bench, and I let the moment sink in, and all the moments leading up to that moment, the ones I hadn't had time to think about or the space to take in. How did I get here? Not just here on this bench, this silence, but more here, this life, this body, this person. The rush from 1 minute to the next came to a glorious pause. And without the noise of schedules or the distraction of entertainment, in the terrible, terrifying, tremendous silence, I felt myself whole. Somehow ready. Alive. I felt fully aware of who I was called to be, and for whom. I enjoyed the subtle victory of knowing myself queer, feminist, mom of two beautiful children, Unitarian Universalist minister-to-be, and former Catholic, all while sitting on a bench in Atlanta, Georgia, observing monastic silence. And in that moment, I thought of Audre Lorde's bitter acknowledgement of what it means to be alive outside of society's expectations. She had said, quote, "We were never meant to survive," unquote. In that quiet moment, I felt my life was as much of any march I'd ever gone on, any letter I'd written, any sermon I'd preached. And then I realized my life right there and then was a protest. Like Thomas Merton says, a rejection of all the forces which threatened to destroy the human race and the world, that my very existence was a statement of resistance of every injustice, and in turn a powerful yes to all that is good in the world. Now it's important to start here, in the silence, for this sermon on resistance, our theme for this month, because too often we go immediately to the most politically charged and publicly visible examples of witness or activism when we think about the word resistance. We think of the solo heroes who capture the news with their public acts, Malala Yousafzai, or Bree Newsom, Cesar Chavez, Martin Luther King Jr., or even Joan of Arc. Starting in the silence reminds us that sometimes the most critical protest begins at home, with a resistance to our usual patterns, to rush, to the noise. It begins with sitting down with our own selves, looking into our own hearts, remembering who we are, collecting ourselves, who we hope to be, and for whom. Taking stock, giving thanks, believing we are already enough, and having eyes to see the miracle of life already unfolding. Unitarian Universalist blogger Mek Groot says it this way, quote, "Social change is an inside job," unquote. Now let me step back for just a moment to clarify this term, resistance. Robin Myers, in his book Spiritual Defiance, Building a Beloved Community of Resistance, which you might correctly surmise informed this sermon title, defines resistance as, quote, "a form of direct or indirect action opposing anything in the dominant culture that brings death and indignity to any member of the human family or to creation itself," unquote. Now, critical to that definition is the word action. Resistance, for our purposes, is not ideological, analytical, or theoretical. It's embodied in action that either directly or indirectly opposes those things that bring death or indignity. Unitarian Universalist theologian Rebecca Parker advocates for UU congregations to act primarily as communities of resistance, what she describes as, quote, countercultural habitations in which people learn to survive and thrive that can resist and sometimes even transform an unjust dominant culture, unquote. Parker envisions everything we do, worship, religious education, service, as tools and practices for resisting injustice. She calls it a counter-education system. Counter-education in congregational life teaches us new practices and habits, for example, to affirm the inherent worth of every person. In counter-education to all those things in our culture which tell us our worth comes from our looks, our homes, our jobs, our incomes, our possessions. You get the idea. Counter-education teaches us new ways to celebrate our inherent worth. But it can't stop there. Parker asserts that our communal life, quote, must also train our members to use their imagination, compassion, creativity, conscience, and senses to unmask that which harms life, to resist those forces, cultivating the rituals and spiritual disciplines that disrupt demonic powers so as to liberate ourselves and others from harmful ways of life, unquote. Now, this relates to how we have been learning to explore what it means to welcome transgendered people into our fold. Now, I have to pause here to underscore that the sort of resistance we're after focuses on things or forces rather than on people. People are usually the movers and enablers of those forces we may need to resist, but our theology reminds us to refuse to put some people on the good guy side and some people on the bad guy side. And instead, to recognize that we all, at any time, contain the potential to further the cause of those things that may bring indignity, injustice, destruction, or death. I drove my car that requires fossil fuel to church this morning. I drank a cup of coffee from a K-cup. And I'm living in a house that most people in the world would consider appropriate to house three or even four times the number of people in my family. I have central air and I use it. I could go on. Any of us could, I imagine. Go on identifying those ways where we intentionally or unintentionally further the cause of injustice or indignity to life on our planet. But resisting me, or any of us as a person, insisting on that kind of ideological purity in order to imagine transformation is not a helpful path. Instead, as William Urey's great book on conflict transformation, Getting to Yes, has said, quote, focus on the problem, not the people, unquote. We need to focus on resisting the systems, the structures, the habits, the policies, the practices that bring death or indignity to our world, rather than focus on our resistance on people. Now, personally, speaking of myself as Chris Hinkla, I find that sometimes a little hard to do. More intimately, this difficult discernment also plays itself out in our neighborhoods, our workplaces, our holiday dinner tables, even our gyms. The other day, my daughter came home from our new gym telling a story of homophobic teasing from one of her peers. It was hard to figure out how to help her stop this bullying without demonizing the kid who did the bullying. But that is our task. Our overarching commitment is to humanize rather than demonize, and to remember the forces of injustice and evil equally threaten us all. And also to remember my favorite piece of wisdom from Richard Rohr, quote, "Pain that is not transformed is transmitted." I'll repeat that. Pain that is not transformed is transmitted. It's an important time for your congregation as you look ahead to the new ministry you'll begin later this year. And as you discover and work to articulate your identity, a mission statement, or in your case, a purpose statement in your bylaws, articulates a positive vision, those things that you want to clearly say you are for. And yet, as Parker Palmer offers, quote, "If we're serious about what we're for, we need to name what we're willing to stand openly against. It's not enough to say yes to things like love, truth, and justice without saying a loud, clear no to their ruthless enemies, even risking reprisals as we do," unquote. Palmer's right to highlight the risk of saying no. No is much riskier than yes. Yes feels friendlier, more open, and potentially less offensive. No highlights our intent to disrupt the status quo, upset what is currently in the way of our yes, undo those things that might seem comfortable, traditional, right. Easier to say that we are for peace than to name what we see as the enemy of peace and to actively work to resist and change those things. Without the no, a yes doesn't actually mean much. It's a yes without limits or boundaries. Anything can be imagined in a yes that lacks a complementary no. And if anything is possible by your yes, then what does your yes actually mean? The inverse also applies, of course. A no without a complementary yes shuts off growth, relationship, creativity, and vision. It appears that our natural resistance to change means no is a default. This has been a challenge for us as a religious movement, to move from our no and get clear instead on our yes. Many of us arrive knowing the religion we don't want, what things or ideas we don't believe in, all the stuff we left behind or seek refuge from, whatever we rejected or have been injured by. There's no shortage of religious injury. However, if we are clear about our no, our work must then become articulating the positive vision and positive theology at the heart of our community and our faith. though it can be temporarily energizing to be against a common enemy, if we are to be a living tradition, we must be creators rather than simply detractors. Builders of new ways rather than only tearing down the old. Similarly, we can often ground our work for justice in what we are against. Against fracking, against racism, against poverty. Rebecca Parker reminds us that resisting these or other forces must be grounded in more than our outrage or grief in order to be sustainable or sustaining. Instead, she encourages our resistance to be grounded in, quote, a deep affirmation of life's goodness, in celebration of life's beauty, and receptivity to grace, unquote. Holding this positive vision as our foundation sustains our activism through refreshing experiences of beauty and joy. I suggest that you look to your purpose as a means to clarify and affirm your identity and your dreams, remembering not only to articulate what you are for, but also to claim clearly what you are against, to consider your lives and this congregation as a protest, a living, breathing act of resistance against all those things which stand in the way of your vision, those forces in your own hearts which would cause you to stumble, those habits in your own lives which keep you from who you are meant to be, and those dehumanizing forces in the world which work against the beloved community. Let us imagine not just our lives will do no harm, that our community will be a place of sanctuary, but also that we will be active agents in undoing the harm that has already been done. So that as we invite someone into membership into our church, and as we each feel moved in this faith, we might imagine we are being recruited into a great countercultural resistance of love, a joyful effort that seeks in small and big ways to offer our lives as witness to and keepers of the great story of human connection, goodness, beauty, equality, and love. So that we might say to each person as they arrive among us, welcome to this beloved community, this beloved community of resistance. Amen. Namaste. May it be so.